Hello, Zero Books readers, listeners, Patreon supporters. This is the Inside Zero Books podcast. It's a special with Rob Larson, the author of Capitalism Versus Freedom. This is going out on all the feeds in order to entice you to support us on Patreon and in order to give you an opportunity to listen to Rob Larson and I discuss the Facebook economy. You've been working on a new book for a different press about Silicon Valley and the tech giants. That I'm really curious to hear about what you're working on now and what your take is on people like Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah, right on. So, yeah, the next big project I'm finishing up now has to do with kind of what a lot of us are seeing as the new rising core industry in capitalism. You know, capitalism, of course, has a real historical record of evolving over time and tearing down its old processes and building up new ones. But also, there is some continuity, and a lot of us on the left have historically identified Wall Street and financial capital as being sort of, in a lot of ways, at the center of the system because of its pivotal role of controlling access to capital and the concentration in those credit markets being one of the main processes that drives what happens in the rest of the system and what it allows and what it doesn't allow. And I think that's really sensible. I've done that myself. But I think it's possible to identify the rising tech sector as, I mean, I think I'm going to be making this claim in the manuscript looking through the evidence here. I think we can start to see it as becoming co-dominant with Wall Street and the financial services sector at the core of our whole, you know, evolving market economy and all the political economy that revolves around that, certainly politically and also culturally. And there's a lot of ramifications of its rise to power and just the new technology itself that has enabled that. So looking at these things, I mean, these giant tech companies, they have some things in common. You know, looking at Microsoft, which sort of was the original sort of platform monopoly of the digital era. Back in the 90s, and the only one to get in trouble so far for its monopoly. But you look at Apple and its phones, if you look at Facebook, and certainly Google and its various platforms, and Amazon too, with its secondary user marketplace. I think what we're seeing is these companies are kind of pure cases for what in, you know, sort of conventional economics we call network effects, right? Some goods, when you consume them, it doesn't affect anyone else. You know, if you buy a pair of sneakers, that doesn't make my sneakers more valuable. But for services that are distributed through networks, it's totally different. If someone, if you know, if you've got a phone and you're the only one with a phone, great, call yourself, you know. But once a couple other people have phones, now your phone is worth something because you can reach out to someone and have communication. And so networks have these unique characteristics that economists talk about. They have certain characteristics, and one is that they really encourage monopolies. And they, you know, reward a uniform standard being adopted. And if you're a company that can get in the market at the right time and kind of get a good early break, like gaining a large base of users relatively early, you can parlay that into a full-on, almost pure monopoly. And I mean, that's the story of Windows and its friggin' lousy operating system. But because software writers wanted to prepare games and business applications for the biggest market, they went with Windows because it got that early deal with the IBM PC and the resulting clones. And if you look at Google and in other cases too, like especially Facebook, these things have straight network-based monopolies that have very little to do with the quality of the network itself, especially Facebook. Google has a somewhat better case.
It seems like you're describing a situation where a product will be more valuable when a certain kind of production has transformed the market. So, for instance, you mentioned the phone. You could also think of the automobile. The automobile was a valuable product. It was something people wanted, but it really didn't come into its own until there was a state spending on creating roads and highways, right? And then you had a network of connection that where that automobile that automobile could fit into. So is that an example of
the network effect?
Yeah, and you know, these ideas definitely have fuzzy borders, so some of them are, you know, kind of debatable, or you have to give them some thought. Here, I mean, that one, I mean, my first thought is no, because, you know, if I get a car, that doesn't make a car more valuable for you. But if more and more people are buying those and that market is growing, there's going to be an inevitable pressure or just a straight incentive for governments to, yeah, you know, create a network of paved roads for those cars to have value and to support that market, which, as we all know, is what, a lot of what the state does. So that might be an indirect network effect. I mean, my thought there is that seems more like a straight infrastructure, you know, public subsidy to the private car and truck market. It could be debatable. Like, the thing that makes it a clear network effect is when some new person using it increases its value to you. And so something like, you know, YouTube or especially Facebook, people want to get on the network that their friends are on if they want to do social media. You get on the one your friends are on, so the existing network has this big advantage of incumbency. But when new people do connect, that's more people you can look at, more people's phony stage-managed profiles that you can look at. It does add value to those networks. So,
what do you mean when you say value in this context? Are you talking about how useful it is for the consumer, or are you talking about its price?
Potentially, you know, usually one and then the other, I would say. Yeah, first, it's more people you can communicate with on Facebook, or more people on YouTube whose videos you can view. That does tend to mean, though, that network becomes more valuable and then they can charge a higher price. And certainly that was the case with AT&T and its phone monopoly with its rates, although it was at least regulated, unlike most of our current network monopolies. So if you look at Google and Facebook, like as YouTube and Facebook and Instagram have exploded in use, their ad rates have increased. Even those that are driven through an auction, like Google's auction-based ad platform, those rates do go up.
Right.
So
okay,
I'd say
so
first
that's,
one and
that's
then the
interesting.
Other.
But and here's the thing about that is what you, I think. If I just feel like those two things are very different. Like a telephone, the price of using the telephone as a going up because AT&T had a monopoly is one kind of increase, and then the price of the ads going up is something very different. But it does, in both cases, it has to do with property relations, right? And the fact that there's no competition, and it's a product that everyone wants in terms of the phone, means that they can charge roughly what they want for it because they don't they're not constrained by other. Like usually when you have two people producing commodities, you have competition in pricing based on the speed of production. So, you know, if you, there's kind of a set price because it takes a certain amount of time for anyone to create, let's say, a bar of soap. And so a bar of soap might range in price based on ingredients, and it might range in price maybe artificially because of popularity and brand. But in general, there's a kind of a socially necessary price for a bar of soap because the means of production are going to be the same across the board and from one company to another. It's going to be basically uniform, and the competition will be to see how fast you can produce these things and how you can get profits by charging more than it actually costs you for the production of a bar of soap. And then when everyone catches up to you, then the price of soap goes down. So, within a monopoly situation, you can use a property relation to increase the price. And that's the case with the telephone. With Google, it's important, I guess, to realize that the ads are the product and not the service itself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you got it. That's kind of what's in my mind there. You know, because you're saying, what about the price of the product? Where you can hear people who aren't thinking hard everywhere saying, but they're free. But it's free. It's so, how can you say that? You don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, well, it's because you're the product talking, you jerk. Like, that's, of course, the issue. Like, you creating your profile, you know, posting ads on YouTube. You are not directly creating money, right? You create money for the firm by them selling ads that you then view with the front of your face. It seems simple enough. But exactly, yeah, so that's where that would arise too. And of course, really have to bear in mind, and I mention this a lot in my new manuscript, like these are new industries. Like this is, I mean, although I am saying they have these strong patterns, these network patterns that definitely harken back to monopoly network-based monopolies of the past, like AT&T or Western Union and the Telegraph.
Yeah, NBC, NBC, you know, the major networks in television are all going to be able to make their profits based on having a monopoly over the airwaves and charging what they can for television advertising.
That's right. And like you said, the social relationship of this, of course, is, you know, sort of in the background of all this discussion. What this leads to, because of the, you know, attractiveness of existing popular platforms, the network effect tends to make them grow gravitationally. Once you have a good enough lead, if you're able to scale and come up with the resources from venture capitalists to keep piling on new servers and network equipment to host all those web profiles or run all those searches or provide space for those videos, if you're able to keep up with that, which is not so easy considering how fast networks grow when they take off, it's pretty breathtaking. But if you're able to handle that, early incumbents tend to have extremely strong advantages, and some, like Facebook, if they're able to outscale their early rivals, like Friendster, for example, which was unable to grow fast enough and had terrible load times and kind of killed the platform. If you're able to get through that, then you can become a full-on, you know, monopolist. And even when Facebook has new competitors, like Instagram, it'll buy them. And if you look at this now, Facebook, I mean, the Wall Street Journal reports on this, like Facebook has a little war room. And you're like, oh, sure, to fight its big online platform rivals like Google and entities like that, or, you know, Twitter. But not so much. It's there to monitor startups and to find any startup that might later pose a threat and to, you know, find out what it, analyze its product, copy it, and then offer it to your existing huge user base. Facebook does this all the time, and that is what Microsoft did all through the 90s. Like, there is a lot of historical echoing there. And it's funny, too, because the language that they use is, and they say this, this is what the Wall Street Journal put it, they said they're on the lookout for any company that might potentially disrupt Facebook. And they said it unironically. They didn't, like, do it in a playful way. I'm not sure if they realized, you know, like, these are the big disrupting firms. Oh, what do you know? Now they're the new establishment, you know, rising core of capitalism. And they're now the ones stomping on startups if they might pose a threat one day. But, and also to get back to what you said, too, about the social relations here, what I'm sort of taking to be understood just in this conversation is that once you have something like a monopoly, in this case, a platform monopoly, there's plenty of versions of it, it is an extremely severe kind of social relationship. The amount of control that Google and Facebook already have over what we see and how we, you know, engage politically is pretty serious. And if folks want to learn about that, of course, they should take a look at the book I've got out now, Capitalism versus Freedom from the Zero Books. And in that section, I have in the first chapter there, I have a discussion about this version of monopoly that comes from networks. And we look at Amazon and a few other examples. But that kind of social relation is one we should be foregrounding because, I mean, not only is this the new kind of company that everyone thinks is so positive with our existing economic relations, but it's some of the clearest monopolies that you can have. And these gigantic firms and, you know, Jeff Bezos right now is deciding which American city will have a future as he puts a new headquarters in it, if they promise to never make him pay taxes ever. Like, this is something we should be foregrounding, talking to people. You know, that's a very politically fraught condition right now, and we need these clear examples and the ability to explain just these basic political economic ideas. And so I would say to folks who are struggling, it's autumn now. Soon the high holidays will be here and listeners will be stuck around a table with their reactionary family members and their dumb NRA TV watching Friends for Christmas. Don't go in empty handed. Like, get a couple of good books that will let you guide people through this. You know, I would just suggest books like mine or others that are clearly written and that take up these subjects and let you break down monopoly with, you know, some real substance, but in ways people can understand. Everyone knows who Jeff Bezos and Google are. Like, this should be the pointy edge of the spear of understanding.
Well, in an effort to drive that spear in a little further, let me ask you some clarifying questions here. Because it seems like there's two critiques of, let's call it, the Facebook economy. One is the ones that you're mentioning, and maybe you're mentioning both of them, but the main one is the way in which this the tech industry is generating monopolies, and the monopolies have a lot of contradictory effects on the economy that run against even the values of, say, the capitalists, entrepreneurs, and libertarians. The problem with the Facebook economy is that it is itself a driver against technical and innovation. You mentioned that when you talked about how they're trying to either stamp out or sweep up disruptors, right? And then when they sweep them up, that's a little bit better in terms of innovation than when they stamp them out. But I recall working for Comcast, and there was an attempt to throttle broadband internet use as much as possible because it was a threat to their primary business, which is television, cable television. This was 10 years ago. So they were feeling very much as though the coming onslaught from streaming video services like Netflix was going to be a big problem for them. And so they wanted to discourage their users from watching videos on the internet. This was, you know, a countervailing force against innovation. But on the other hand, around that same time, all the big tech companies, all the internet service providers got together to fund the proliferation of smartphones and especially 3G internet service. That was something everyone was on board with. One thing it was doing, although again, was striving against innovation because they were saying, we want to make 3G cellular phone service the way people get online. We want that when you go online, we want you to do it on your phone through the 3G signal or the 4G signal. And that was pushing against projects at the time to make Wi-Fi universally available in cities. Free internet, right? The other thing was it was a way to get around net neutrality at the time. Because 3G and 4G are not protected, you can create very controlled internet experiences through a cell phone connection that you can't get away with or you didn't used to be able to get away with when it came to broadband or dial-up. That's one problem. The problem of basically squelching innovation, but also limiting the power of the internet to be a new tool for regular people to talk to each other and communicate. It squelches and controls speech to have monopoly powers and control of it. And people were recently, you know, pretty happy when Alex Jones was deplatformed, and it was very hard to try to defend him, but it did show that a couple of companies could really just wipe out a person's right or ability to communicate. And so, okay, so there's that. But then there's the other side of this, which is that when you're dealing with an industry which is basically property capitalism rather than productive capitalism. In other words, when you're dealing with an industry which only can make money by taking a cut from the productive sectors, then you might have an artificial understanding of how your economy is doing. You know, if Facebook is making billions, that doesn't mean we have a strong economy overall, even if our GDP is going up. Because some of that could be based on financialization as well. So you have companies that are highly financialized with tons of debt buying ads to sell products on Facebook, right? Right. But the overall productivity and reinvestment in production would be down, possibly. It could conceivably be that way. It's not necessarily a great sign that our leading industries are rentier class industries.
Yeah, you're rentier. That's interesting. Well, to me, the real story here is that you worked for Comcast. I want to hear more about that. Oh, yeah. Well, hell, you know, we all exist in the marketplace. We got to make money. I'm sure I've worked for someone at least as heinous as Comcast, if I think about it. I worked for Borders Books for several years.
I'm not worried about my reputation. I mean, I was so low tier at Comcast. I worked there, you know, in the call center. I was not calling any shots. I was simply showing up. I eventually got fired from that job because on a call, I didn't try to sell every product to the customer. And at that point, I got my unemployment from them, even though I was fired, because I demonstrated that it was unfair firing. Yeah, but it was a tough time. That was right around the time I first started podcasting in 2009. So I got fired from there in 2010. Anyway, so enough about that.
To me, this is all about the logic of the platform. You know, the way that these, like the way Microsoft's Windows monopoly worked was, you know, once they have a big core of users, it attracts the software developers who make the accounting software and the video games that people play in the 90s. It strengthened Windows and Microsoft's monopoly because it attracted more users and then more web developers. Like, these platforms are like that too. And I mean, this really does actually, you know, I mean, the Rentier comparison is a good one to bring up. I mean, Facebook, this is true of, but I think Google is the ultimate example of this. And everyone loves Google and their wonderful free products, and they have this lovely culture, and they let you spend one day of the week doing what you want, although that's really just for engineers, and there's still an approval process. And if you look at it, these are, you're still developing products for Google, and most of those workers just end up putting in another, you know, it's a, some people call it 120% time, because that 20% is on top of really working full time already, the way that these firms have a culture of aggressive hours. There's a lot to say about Google specifically, but all of their success is built around indexing and organizing access to the broader web. And in the case of their giant YouTube subsidiary, you know, organizing people's video they put online, they create, you know, and from the point of view of the overall amount of content, a negligible amount of content. It's just having, you know, a good algorithm for creating access to these things, but then it's just having, being able to invest in all those servers to host those videos and to make all those Google searches extremely time efficient. But all they're doing is creating a convenient access and search function for an ocean of content created by other people. Like, really what they're doing is, you know, yes, you bought this YouTube platform at an opportune time. Yes, you created a good search algorithm that was far better than any other that existed back when they came into existence at the turn, became prominent at the turn of the century. But past that, it's just laying in the cut. Like, that's what being a platform is. Like, it's not dissimilar to the Windows OS in the primitive days of the 90s. What you did was, you're in a good place at the time. Maybe you did some good work. But after that, it is a Rentier. Like, you couldn't have a clearer picture.
The primitive days of the 90s. So we were driving horses and buggies around.
And working for the telecom industry and the book retail firms, yes. That's, I mean, that to me is a very important thing. And I just finished up the chapter on Facebook for this project, and it's a little lower now, partly because of the money they're spending coping with the backlash that they're dealing with. But for Facebook, for its glory days, its profit rate was 50%, which is this cartoonishly huge, huge proportion of profitability. You know, their net income was at that level. That's fantastic. High. It's because they're a Rentier. People pile on and all the content is created for free when people upload their boring photos of their food and when they post about how their cat is on their keyboard. That is all, that is completely free for them. And then they market all those eyeballs are there. The product, of course, yes, is the advertising service that they offer. And that's, again, they call themselves an advertising firm when they're, you know, speaking amongst themselves. Like, that's how Sheryl Sandberg described their business model. The business model is advertising. Well, that's a more classic Rentier thing, because say what you will about, yeah, the broadcast networks, which you referred to, which are free to the consumer insofar as if you had rabbit ears or these days a converter box, you could watch that stuff with no cost except for the set itself. But of course, you're paying by being the product exposed to the ads for the actual consumers or the ad companies. The same is true here, but at least the broadcast networks made their own shitty shows. At least you could say, yeah, but I love Magnum PI or whatever it is. You could at least refer to their dumb dramas and their horrible establishmentarian news shows and their shitty comedies. At least they had the responsibility to create some content to lure the eyeballs. Google and Facebook don't even rise to that level. It's all user-generated content. So I think a lot, I've been thinking lately a lot about what socializing these platforms would mean and what an online socialism would be. The first thing is to recognize, people always talk about how these firms have such small workforces. Yes, because we do the work of creating all the damn content. The socialism starts with us, the workers, which is, you know, we're the content creators. We're doing the work. So that's something I've been thinking.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. We could – this is something that Jody Dean talks about too, that like the people who use these services are uncompensated workers creating the content. But I just don't think that it really holds, because I don't think that an actor in a soap opera is a worker in the same way that someone who even cuts hair for a living or serves ice cream is a worker. There's the labor is, it's all, even with NBC, it's about owning the property rather than it is about producing a product. And so we kind of misspeak when we talk about TV shows and movies as products or properties. But the other thing is they're not commodities. But the other thing that I want to think about is how Facebook's – to what extent Facebook and Google – and with Google it's really different. But Facebook particularly relies on a thriving service economy and consumer economy, because their ads are not aimed at productive capitalists. They're not like advertising. Like, you know, there are whole industries that never interact with the consumer, with the consuming class, right? You can have an industry that what they do is they produce surgical tools, say, and those are purchased by hospitals. And yeah, they're used on people, but they're not purchased by any consumer. They're purchased by hospitals. You can have whole lines of industries that are, their job is to make gears that are then put into, you know, I'm thinking like 19th century or whatever, you know, factories. But, you know, and so, and again, they're not ever out in the market for regular consumption. They're consumed for production. And that's a huge section of most capitalist economies. But in, so for the major industry, for the biggest profitable sector of the U.S. economy to be the digital sector, which I'm not sure it is, actually. If it were the case, that would say something kind of scary about the productive sector. Do you know what share of the overall economy is going to this rentier digital world?
Yeah, not really.
From Adweek Magazine, 2015. For anyone down on advertising, the Association of National Advertisers and the Advertising Coalition commissioned a study that highlights some of the industry's big economic benefits. Namely, advertising contributed $3.4 trillion to the U.S. GDP last year, a figure that accounts for 19% of the country's entire economic output.
With the fast change in the industry, and because that it's reshaping how so many other firms operate now, I myself haven't seen any research on exactly what that is. And I imagine it's partially because, like a lot of this, like any industrial transformation, right? Part of it is the growth of those companies themselves, but a lot of this is investments being made by older economy firms developing this new technology.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to know. The other thing I wanted to ask you is, do you use Google Docs to write?
Only when I'm working on a project with someone else who does. I usually use lousy Word because of the network effect. Most editors expect that. Most writers have experience with it. So when you share documents around, you know they'll be able to open those up. But I use Google Docs. You know, it's definitely extremely convenient to use.
I use Google Docs all the time, but I started doing it as a freelancer working in the corporate sector more, because when I was working for digital companies that didn't really need to produce like magazines or books or anything, they would be glad to use Google Docs. They didn't ever really want a Word document. But but it's absolutely the case. So when you're writing for a publication, you're still going to be using Word. And my God, I think Word has gotten really bad. Like, it's not a very friendly piece of software anymore. It seems like it's, I don't know. Maybe I just have got out of touch with it. But I remember back in the day, in the early aughts, Word used to be pretty intuitive, and now I can't. I have to search for every function I want to do.
It's by now most of the Office applications are considered to be notorious for being super bloated, jammed with features. And you can do damn near anything with a Word document. But yeah, if you're looking for something that's not the immediate dashboard stuff. And actually, there's several dashboards now. Like, it is, I mean, it's over the top, I would say. And if you read about it, they've been trying to strip it down a little bit more. Microsoft itself is reconfiguring to be more of a cloud providing company now. They actually downgraded the importance of Windows within the company this year, which was unheard of. So that particular slightly older digital behemoth is kind of going through some reevaluation. But yeah, it's stuff. Then you look at Google's interfaces. They're so simple. You know, you often have a lot of options, but they're sort of put in a relatively intuitive location that you can dig up. It's definitely more user-friendly. I mean, they have that reputation, and I think it's the case. And it shows, like, there is... Like, you know, these are markets. Like, up to a point, consumers like to shift and go from one to another. But again, those networks are enduring. Like, I wouldn't mind going over to Google Docs. I wouldn't have to keep paying a stupid license to Microsoft to have.
Yeah, that's the other thing. I was like, I decided I needed Word, and now I don't even remember how much I'm paying per month to keep Word.
Yes, they moved over to subscription model. It's a real pain. I actually fought to get on my laptop. I purchased the software, and now I think if you want to do it now, I don't even know if that option still exists. I think only institutions can purchase it now.
It's like $10 a month to have Word or some crazy thing like our Office, right? Like, that's just crazy. What am I doing paying a subscription fee for a piece of software on my hard disk?
What you're doing is you're paying for the ability to make a document in a format that is what is expected and used by most people. Like, that is how they're persisting today, and it's how Windows ran the online economy in the 90s. It's because people want a standard. They want a uniform standard so that they know that they'll be able to open this document and fiddle with it. Whereas Google Docs, maybe I don't, you know, that's, I'm not formatted for that. Like, now I have to convert the document. Like, that has driven so many monopoly dollars. I mean, hell, that's how Microsoft, you know, went to trial after all.
Right. I'm paying rent is what I'm doing to use Word.
Yeah. I mean, it's literally rent. Yeah. It's literally a rent here in that case. My God.
Yeah.
That's clear as it gets, I guess.
Right. So, it's interesting world that we're in. And the internet, as I remember it back in the Wild West days of the 90s. I mean, I still want it all, you know, now, of course, all the time. I live on the internet practically. But back in the 90s and early aughts, there was definitely a sense that the web was open and that you would, you know, that aesthetic of the kind of shitty 90s web page, that was what you would find online. So you could... And Google was the big tool still even then in the early aughts, because if you wanted to find that shitty GeoCities webpage that would tell you all, you know, all the episodes of Star Trek Next Generation, and you could debate people in some bulletin board or something, you had to use Google to get there. But now I think that's kind of all gone away. So that's the other thing I wanted to, I guess, ask you. Do you have any idea as to what extent the big monopolies are shaping, like, let's say something like Jacobin or Current Affairs or Zero Books. I mean, are we getting slowly eaten up by these entities without knowing it?
Well, I think I would tend to answer yes, but I say there's sort of two sides to that. One is, of course, that most of these sites or, you know, publications can exist because of the traffic that comes from these platforms. When people want to learn, you know, when a kid, you know, is into Bernie Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez and wants to learn about socialism and goes to Jacobin, it's probably going to be through a Google search. Or maybe they'll see a link on Facebook, right? I remember, Nathan Robinson at Current Affairs wrote a very hilarious article about how much his publication hates Facebook and how they're utterly reliant on it. And any tweak to their algorithms to downgrade it or hide it from viewers or consider it contentious, so maybe now we're censoring that, Facebook changes its stance frigging constantly on that stuff, that could utterly destroy his publication. And he was sort of acknowledging that. I mean, that's a form of already being digested by them. On the other hand, too, like you referred to with Alex Jones, yeah, everyone – I mean, look, we were all delighted to see misfortune strike Alex Jones, and that's fine. I think we'd all be delighted if we could somehow see him slip and fall in the mud and dirty his pants. I think we'd be happy with that, because he's so heinous and so utterly bullying and filled with bizarre, feverish fraud. It's just you can't help but want to see even the pettiest of misfortune fall on him. So that's understandable. But at the same time, a lot of folks on the left, like Matt Taibbi wrote in The Rolling Stone, and you're kind of referring to this too, is that this just shows that the bull, you know, the gun is in Facebook and Google's hands. And if they want to deplatform any of us, it can happen. And even now, like the far right, like right-wing imbeciles like Ann Coulter saying, how long until Google decides to make it so you can't get to Breitbart? Because she doesn't even understand what net neutrality is actually about. No one's saying the website won't exist. We're saying it won't be given equal treatment or, you know, or equal access to a platform like Google. But it does show, like this history is already there. Some time ago, I'm just now working on this material on Google, but it's already got episodes on its record of times when they were getting criticized for not being right-wing enough or for not having credible enough news sources, which of course means establishmentarian corporate news sources. And they effectively, in their search algorithm, downranked this extensive list of not even leftist, but just liberal sources like Alternet and real socialist ones as well, sources like Truthout and a number of others. This got some coverage on the left at the time. FAIR, the media monitoring group, had a good article about this that folks can Google up if they want to learn about it. But it's interesting, like, the point is people are saying, oh, look at Alex Jones, like the smarter, you know, some people are going, yay, Facebook did the right thing. Others are saying this proves they have creepy power over who gets access. And I mean, we on the left are historically the victims of getting blackballed out of institutions through McCarthyism and COINTELPRO. Like, our first thought is, how long till they turn these guns on us? Well, guess what? It happened already a few years ago with Google. So, I mean, to what extent are these guys digesting us, you're saying, or shaping access? It's already on the record. It's happening now. And I think a lot of folks on the left at least see this clearly. I feel like that's an area where folks are relatively clear-eyed.
Yeah, it's kind of... Well, we are inconsistently clear-eyed, but yeah, I think you're right. People do get it. And I do recall feeling as though certain publications that used to be very easy to find and they were constantly kind of flitting across my news feed on Facebook sort of dropped away, like Alternet. Alternet is no longer something I don't go to that page anymore. And it's not because I don't want to. It's just that I don't go to pages voluntarily that much. It was all, you know, like I am being fed a stream of information from these social media sources that I supposedly hate. So it's a very interesting relationship. Is that the network effect at work? Because it's such a useful product for me that I then become just entirely reliant and kind of addicted to it? Or how is that working on the consumer side, do you think?
Yeah, right on. Well, it's definitely like some of this, I think, is the nature of the technology. And I talk about this a lot in the book, this new book I'm working on. The very first thing I say is, let me say I use these companies' products constantly. And we're already kind of getting at that with the Microsoft thing. My view is these products and services are extremely useful. And I don't think that Facebook, like, you know, being able to be in touch with people who live far away, who you might not be close enough to email or send a phone call to, like, there's some legitimate utility in the software on that platform. And Google, above all, like, that's a legitimately useful piece of software. I do 20 Google searches a day and watch crap on YouTube constantly, as we all do. This isn't us caving to capitalism or something. This is – they've developed legitimately useful services here, and we need to use them because they offer us so much that's legitimately useful. I mean, obviously, we're kind of over-dependent on these. We can talk about that too. But – the point, no one's saying get rid of Google because I watch too much on YouTube. Like, it's really, really useful. The thing I would draw people's attention to, I talk about this in the manuscript as well, is that the large majority of this technology is publicly developed. And some of us are familiar with that, especially with regard to the internet itself, which, of course, was originally called DARPANET because it was developed by the Pentagon's research arm, DARPA, and a number of universities and computer sciences programs that was developed out from there and eventually privatized. But if you look at the technology within the iPhone and other smartphones, it was almost the entirety of those components were developed by various Pentagon and university and public agencies. And it's amazing to take a look at this. Folks should pull up a book. I forget the author's name, but the book is The Entrepreneurial State. It is an impeccable, extremely aggressively documented history of how this tech, with all of its handy features and its drawbacks too, it was developed by us and our parents paying taxes in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. That's where this research comes from. Corporations are under near-term profit constraints, like real scientific research, that basic R&D usually comes from some arm of the public sector, and that's true here. So my thought is a lot of these, you know, like, people live in small towns. They don't have bookstores. They need a service like Amazon. There's too much on the web to find what you need on your own. You need a search engine like Google. These things are legitimately useful. They shouldn't be the corporate property of some douchebags who managed to get a patent on it at just the right time. You know, the internet was called DARPANET. Google's original name was google.stanford.edu because, of course, it was developed at this big public research institution or this big research school in California with an at National Science Foundation grant. Like, there's public money all through this stuff. So, like, there's that. But then also, like, how much we use this stuff. And, like, you were referring to, like, how some news sources you used to see a lot on your feed you tend not to see anymore. Like, there's a couple possibilities there. And of course, we don't know which one it is because these algorithms are utterly opaque. They're intellectual property that these companies will fight to the death to defend in court. So it's hard to know exactly. But one big feature of it, of course, is that these algorithms, you know, they're based on learning and from your behavior. I talk about this in the book a bit as well. If you take a look at these guys, it's very interesting because you will start out doing some searches or looking at some sources that you're interested in. It will then start showing you those sources more. And the tendency is to exaggerate whatever interests or predispositions you had coming in the door. And if you look at a lot of coverage lately of these firms like Facebook and Google's YouTube especially, a lot of the discussion is how come people get so radicalized, as people say, on these platforms? They start out just conservative and soon they're huge right-wing, you know, they're fans of crazy Alex Jones stuff, and you know, we have similar developments with lots of different ideologies across the spectrum. It's because of the adaptation of this software. It clicks on, you know, it shows you more of what you clicked on previously, and people talk about the filter bubble and how the tendency is for us to get more and more locked into our views. I mean, this comes from direct features of the software. The software does that because they found if they show you a slightly more extreme version of the views you've got already, you're much more likely to click on that. Like, it generates real commerce and you're watching more videos or looking at more crazy left or right wing profiles, and now you're watching more ad dollars. Like, the models do work. Sometimes they do it by aggravating our starting views and maybe in.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I make YouTube videos now. And I have I've grown to the channel's grown to such an extent now that I'm like impatient when I want to get, you know, with its current, like, before it was like, oh, we're almost at 10,000 subscribers, and hooray, and now I'm like, oh, we're at 30,000 subscribers. That's not nearly enough, right? And I've discovered that if I make a video on Jordan Peterson, I get twice to three times as many views as any other subject that I cover. And, yeah. And so I'm trying to figure out, like, how to get the algorithm to like my other content. You know, right? I mean, what do I do to make – and also there's a diminishing returns on the Jordan Peterson stuff too, to a degree. So
less and less worth it. That's interesting. You know, like, that's something true. I hadn't thought about that so much, but that's a really good point. Like, the truth is, I'm definitely guilty of this as well. You know, anytime you're writing something for or doing any kind of product for people's consumption, you know, you're hoping it's a success and you're hoping to figure out what people are most excited about. These platform media now are quite happy to tell you exactly the metrics of how many views or clicks or whatever that your content creates. And I will utterly right now say I have been completely guilty of obsessively watching website performances on Google Analytics and watching, you know, this engagement numbers on stupid Twitter. I'll plead guilty to it right now because I, you know, spent years working on articles and books and I want to see how much attention they're getting right from these platforms.
Well, the click-through rate's everything. That's a click-through rate.
Yes.
And everything.
And so, I live for those retweets, man. I can't get by without those.
And sometimes I have to remind myself, oh no, you know what matters is book sales.
Exactly. Can we get back to the healthy values of old values?
Right.
You said it.
Right. Oh man. So like my click through, it's weird. It's you can get obsessed with these metrics and completely lose sight of just forget about your actual values, but just like you said, like the what about how much money you're making off the thing? Well, that doesn't even matter anymore. As long as my click through rate is higher than 10%, I'm good. Or as long
yeah, and it is rough too because people like do want to focus on their fun projects. People with their shitty capitalist and gig economy jobs, like I doubt you're getting an ocean of satisfaction out of your, Lyft gig. So then, yeah, you want people to pay attention to your band or your writing or your photography or whatever, your cool videos or whatever it is. This, like, people have that interest now, and you can look at your phone anytime and see what kind of hits or views you're getting. I mean, some of that really, I think, is taking people away from, what's going on with the real economy. Like, yes, I may not be able to make ends meet. Yes, I don't have health insurance for my job anymore, but at least I got these sweet, sweet clicks coming in to keep me cold.
Right. I mean, if you get enough of them, you can make hundreds of dollars a month.
That potential's there, but again, too,
hundreds,
I like that
and
because...
hundreds, not thousands. Not enough to live on.
Yes.
Hundreds.
I always like to say hundredths of thousands of dollars. Yeah. It's interesting because that potential's definitely there. And again, it speaks to how powerful these platform monopolists and their network effects become, because as soon as they tweak an algorithm slightly, let alone ban somebody for content that they don't care for this week, as soon as that happens, so many people have their ability to make money thrown up in the air because they built their business relying on their Amazon storefront and its marketplace platform, or they built their videos around exposure, on YouTube or the like. And then they get, their access changed or the algorithm disadvantages them. It's a crippling thing. And it destroys their publication or ruins their band's ability to get anyone to pay attention to them. And there are famous cases like that woman who had an online video channel on YouTube and was putting up workout videos and so on. And some of them were judged provocative. And she had her channel banned and she went to YouTube and shot up the place. Like, this just speaks... I'm not saying people should do that. I'm saying that this speaks to the incredible arbitrary authority that they've got. And of course, these are mostly kids who are, little engineering young people and kind of junior technocrats. The last thing they're doing when they make these decisions is thinking, is this a beneficial? I should think about how this is affecting folks. These folks are notorious for being focused on engineering outcomes. And, they may say their idealistic stuff and their don't be evil slogans and so on. But I remember Angela Nagel, my Zero Books fellow, she had this incredibly great article on the tech industry, and I can't think just now what its title was. I think it was on Current Affairs. Folks can Google it. one of the concluding lines is incredibly powerful. It's saying Silicon Valley may like the feel-good factor of intersectional multiculturalism, but there are other things they like more, like monopoly capitalism and tax evasion. I thought that really, really – people have a lot of views about Nagel. In my opinion, she has a way of cutting through the shit. I think that's a good example of that.
The key to avoid if you're a writer or a producer or something like that is to follow the – algorithm too closely, because I do think what I guess I was getting at was, not only does it influence the way people consume the product, but it also has a weird way of generating it, certain kinds of ideas, right? The key here is, like, we started making these videos to promote our books, and we still are doing that, we found certain kinds of videos get more clicks, and now you could get to the point where you're, like, hunting down the right keywords to then write a video around to try to go viral. And then what happens, of course, is that not only do your ideas get changed by that, but also, you become indistinguishable from everything else around you. And what I'm really curious about is exactly how these you have to keep in mind what YouTube is trying to do. What they're trying to do is create content that you'll keep watching. They're encouraging binge watching. Netflix has figured out their way of doing it. It's a completely different model from the way YouTube does it. But all YouTube wants you to do is click on the next video and watch some more. And they don't care what you click on. So what I'm wondering is, when they change their algorithm, what's really determining that? Is that a change in the audience's response? I mean, is, or to their previous technique to get you to keep watching? Do we get inured to one response and then they decide, well, we'll try some other approach? Or are they just perfecting and perfecting and perfecting their ability and getting better and better and better at increasing watch time? So that would be another thing to look into on YouTube, is has overall watch time increased at a faster rate, say, than the number of subscribers or the numbers of individuals that are using the channel?
Yeah, that's a great question. YouTube's this fascinating platform unto itself, so it definitely needs some study time. And the scope of these things is insane. I mean, many years of video are uploaded to YouTube every hour. It's this insanely vast, vast platform. So that's, I mean, that's a really interesting question. But I can speak to the issue of the algorithms. I mean, the impression you get following, you know, reading a, you know, books written by tech journalists or insiders and keeping up with the coverage of them, the impression you get is that, yeah, there's a huge amount of ongoing work on the algorithms on all these platforms. And they often use that term iteration to describe, okay, try this tweak to the system. What did that do? Okay, now let's try this. These are the iterations. And it's definitely driven by a number of things. Like you said, the big one, it's true, is to keep people on these platforms. I mean, Google search is a little different. There, the whole value is to quickly get you off that platform. But that's sort of the exception. And Amazon, whenever you buy something, tries to encourage you to watch video on the platform if you have Prime, as many of its customers do. YouTube, yeah, and Facebook as well, are completely built more or less openly around trying to keep you on the platform. But whenever they have specific issues, when they get shit politically for featuring twisted content or for clearly trying to keep young people on their sites forever, like, then they tweak those algorithms. So my impression is this stuff is driven by everything, yeah, from straight technocratic engineering, time spent on platform and ads viewed metrics, all the way up to, we have to mollify Congress right now, so put more right-wing crap on people's news feeds so they think that we're, you know, so that we can appease them. So it seems like it's driven by every kind of, yeah, technocratic, but then also strategic considerations. But it all, to me, it all just gets back to, again, the crazy power that these firms have. And of course, that's the big theme of my book, Capitalism versus Freedom, is look at these companies and the different kinds of power they have. And the conventional traditional view is, when you've got that concentrated power, it's not good for negative freedom. And my God, that means we have a serious problem with capitalism in that.